This is the second week in this new series, Honor Everyone. Honor Everyone is two words taken literally from 1 Peter 2:17. Honor everyone. When you hear the word honor, you might think, oh, that means honor kings, emperors, and honor people in authority. And that's typically how people use the word, and the Bible too says the same thing. Honor kings, honor emperors. Actually, in this very verse, Peter goes on to say that. Honor those in authority. We even say to judges, your honor. That's biblical, but isn't it wonderful that God's word expands this? Don't just honor those in authority. Yes, do so. But honor everyone. Who is everyone? How do we categorize this? Last week we started with moms, mothers. Honor everyone. Honor mothers. And we'll get to fathers, we'll get to singles, we'll get to children. But today let's honor married folk. And I are one, it's true. Married people, husbands, wives, and honor marriage itself. And that brings me to my theme verse. I only have three or four verses for you in this abbreviated message. And usually we walk through a passage. But sometimes we just park it on a couple verses to really unpack the depth and riches of what's being taught. And so for honor marriage, here I offer you the main verse for today, which really says honor marriage very clearly. This is from Hebrews 13, verse 4. Let marriage be held in honor among all. And let the marriage bed be undefiled, for God will judge the sexually immoral and adulterous. I want you to see what's in bold there. Let marriage be held in honor among all. I really got to credit Mark Davis for this. That I heard Mark mention this verse several times, and his point took me a while to really grab onto it. It was a really simple but important point. Let marriage be held in honor among all. Among all. Whether you're married or not. Whether you're a child or an adult. Old or young. Let marriage be held in high honor among all. It's all of our job, all of us. And that's a really great point. And that's what I want to explore, especially at the beginning of the sermon. How do we do that? All of us hold marriage in honor. That's why you might say, well, why is this sermon for me? I'm not married. Well, because we all are supposed to hold it in high honor. Just like moms last week, you might not be a mom. But we're all supposed to honor mothers. So I have 3 points in this somewhat abbreviated message here. And here's the first one, just honoring marriage itself, basing on this verse. How, let's just jump into the practical side. How can we do this? I think of Jesus honoring marriage in what he taught. He honored marriage in what he taught in a way that astonished his hearers. It really disturbed even his disciples when he said, let me talk about divorce. Divorce should be so rare, he says, that only for a failure in the marital relations, in the bedroom, what you see here in Hebrews 13 about sexual immorality. Jesus says that in Matthew 5, Matthew 19, and he makes divorce sound so rare, only with that legitimate basis that his disciples say, whoa, 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 if that's the case for marriage, if it's that permanent, it's better not to be married. And Jesus says, well, marriage isn't for everyone. Let he who can accept this, accept this. And Jesus holding up what marriage is supposed to be there. Now, I walk into this sermon like last sermon, all these sermons, with some trepidation, because I know this arouses sadness and pain for many of us, because what we're going to talk about and what Jesus talks about, going back to creation and the way marriage should be, and the way we would look at moms and the way we would like to look at fathers and all these things, we can bring up failures in our own lives or people around us that have brought great pain, sometimes tragedy, sometimes outright sin and evil. And believe me, I don't want to stir any of that up unnaturally or unhelpfully, but I didn't want that to stop us from exploring what God says about what marriage should be, what moms should be, dads should be. To take especially the long view as we're trying to cultivate here in our own families what things should be like as God intended them. So how can we do this practically? You see what the author of Hebrews immediately goes to. He goes to the bedroom, and it's true. This can destroy a marriage. I talked to a couple recently who were talking about their dad, the mom's dad, and what a horrible story. Where he goes to a place to work multiple times, and little did he know there was a woman there who set her eyes on him to see if she could draw him away from his wife and marry him. And there was even, she was actually making bets with her fellow employees whether she could do it. She did it. And the man then found out he had more than he bargained for in this new family with all kinds of problems. And the family he left, of course, greatly hurt. And it was such a sad story of how, if I could speak about men, adulterous men, or men conceiving adultery, don't know what they're in for. The adulterous man is blind. How else, though, other than avoiding that which Hebrews says so powerfully and bluntly, as you can see in this verse, how else? You know what? We have some great traditions to honor marriage in our society, remembering anniversaries. That's a simple way to honor marriage, whether you're married or not. Maybe the kind that sends anniversary cards. Attending weddings. And weddings being a joyful and solemn occasion. Celebrating, honoring marriage. Anniversary trips. If you're married, good time to take a trip. Refresh your marriage. Feed your marriage. Marriage retreats. I'm still looking for a list of great marriage retreats I can recommend as a pastor. If you've gone on one, let me know, because I'm still kind of collecting this list of marriage retreats. Can be very helpful. Or we used to do this. I'd love to do this again. Date nights. Date nights for married folk with supplying babysitting for you. All of this, honoring marriage. But if I could leave you with one, it's really a million conversations where we honor or dishonor marriage. A million off-the-cuff conversations. I just had one this week. For my day off, I got invited to a golf event, a fundraiser for Young Life. It was great to be there. And I have in the golf cart with me this young life leader. He's still in his 20s. He married his wife super young, even younger than Lisa and I got married. It was great to talk with him. They have two young kids. And I said, tell me about your kids and tell me about how you met your wife. And he went on and talked about his wife in really just wonderful, glowing terms. Starting off talking to her personality. She's kind of quiet, but she likes to laugh at my jokes, which was really helpful. But he was just really glowing about her. Honoring marriage. What if he didn't do that? I was thinking to myself, what do we do? How do we honor marriage if he starts complaining about her, criticizing her? That's where you have a temptation to maybe have a kind of a misplaced sympathy to immediately jump in and say, oh, that's terrible, And maybe feed the fire a little bit. But instead, to honor marriage, you might want to say things like, did your wife know how you feel? She does? Okay. Are you getting help? Are you going to a counselor or something? Instead of feeding the fire, getting to something more constructive. to honor marriage, I think you should see some help. Can I pray for you now, you and your wife? Rather joining in on something that might be unhelpful gossip and criticism. This is all what we aim to be about, honoring marriage as Hebrews teaches us. Let me go to point two. Marriage is also the beginning of a new family. Another reason to honor it. You know this verse. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. Genesis 2:24. This has been summarized as leave and cleave. A man leaves his father and mother. He's still called to honor them, to take care of them, as many of our people, many of you have done in their old age. But to leave them and start a new family unit and to hold fast to his wife, cleave to his wife, leave and cleave. It's a new family unit. I was taught that this is a new family, even before they have children. You know, we use that language of starting a family. But I was taught, and I submit this to you because I like this language, that even before you have children, this new family unit is there, the husband and wife. This is an amazing fact from the Encyclopedia Britannica. Some form of marriage has been found to exist in all human societies, past and present. Some form of marriage is everywhere. Every human society, past and present. Can you think of anything that every human society has in common with the vast differences? This is amazing. Now, we shouldn't be surprised. It goes back to creation, the first human couple, and it spread. But it also has everything to do with family and children. Why every society, how can this be? Every society recognizing marriage, and it has something to do with children, certainly. Children come into this world very needy. We talked about some of this last week. So every society has had an interest in marriage to answer this question: who created this child? And who's responsible for this child? Financially, medically, educationally, who's responsible for this child? And the answer has gone back to marriage. Now, it's true that Tim Keller and all these men I've talked about have had an impact on me. And I want to quote Keller here, or at least allude to him. I remember about 20 years ago or so, I was listening to Tim Keller preach, and he said this, and it just arrested me. He says, as you know, and I didn't know, you know, as you know, many people today think the family is inherently oppressive. The institution of family is an institution that is inherently oppressive. And he's saying this to his educated Manhattan audience, and I heard this and I was like, wait a second. He's saying more than I thought. If you want to say that many families are flawed, if your many families have horrible things happening, whether you want to use the word dysfunctional or even sometimes criminal activity, all these, very true. And we see big problems starting in the book of Genesis already concerning family dynamics. But he was saying something more. That some of these very educated people in his audience, in his congregation knew. And that is the criticism that the family is inherently oppressive. What he means is something like, take slavery in Egypt. An oppressive institution, the slavery in Egypt, and the Lord didn't come to improve their circumstances, but to free them from that Egyptian slavery. And that's what Keller was saying, that some people look at the family that way. I was so glad I heard that, because what he was doing was preparing us for something that's more mainstream now. not just for people educated at certain colleges and certain programs, but this idea of the family inherently oppressive. He opened my eyes years ago, and now we see it more and more. For instance, we can say here in this sermon series, and I hope we will multiple times, that when we say honor everyone, we mean honor from any nation. Certainly as believers, we see the church rightly as consisting of every nation we hope on earth as the gospel goes out, and we have many nations represented even here at this local church. Many races too. Honor everyone from different nations, different races. Amen. In the last few years, we've seen the rise of certain organizations that are against racism, and we want to jump in and say yes, but what if they also say, our goal is also to disrupt the family. Disrupt the family, or sometimes dismantle the family. And that's happened. Where organizations have said both. We're against racism and we want to jump in and say yes. And then they say, and we also want to disrupt the nuclear family. And that's where we as Christians, and I'm so thankful for the Racial Unity Committee here and us in leadership saying, we can't promote these organizations. Because what the Bible says is racism and nationalism, we want to avoid that, reject that. But also, God created the family. It's right for husband and wife to join a new family together, have children, be fruitful and multiply. And for that to be fixed, to be reformed, to be enhanced, to be encouraged, rather than dismantled or intentionally disruptive. So Tim Keller prepared me for this years ago, saying, this is coming. A lot of you have experienced this, that the family is being seen as irredeemable. But there's such good things I want you to know about the family for all the flaws, all the horrible things that can happen. What's even worse is no family, or to be an orphan. I want you to consider this. We find that children reared in intact homes being the mom and dad are there, married for children. Intact homes. Those children do best in educational achievement, emotional health, familial and sexual development, delinquency, and incarceration, prison. Children, on the other hand, living with a mother's boyfriend are about 11 times more to be sexually, physically, or emotionally abused than children living with their married biological parents. And listen to this. Children separated from one or both of their biological parents. And again, I know that's many of our situations here. And I don't mean to say anything unhelpful to you. I really don't. But for us to take the long view, this is worth saying how important the family is. Children separated from one or both of their biological parents. Listen to all these stats. They are 1.5 times as likely to experience financial difficulty. 6 times as likely to have witnessed neighborhood violence. 15 times as likely to have witnessed caregiver or parent violence. 11 times as likely to have lived with a caregiver or parent with a drug or alcohol problem. 17 times as likely to have had a caregiver or parent in jail. In short, listen to this. There is virtually no measurement of well-being. These are all different measurements of well-being. You could go into all kinds of other measurements. There is virtually no measurement of well-being in which it is not a significant and even a life-altering advantage to be raised by one's biological and married father and mother. Now, this is from a book. I still haven't read it. It's a recent book. I think I can recommend it without reading, by Katie Faust. Listen to the name of this book, Them Before Us, referring to children before adults, their needs before our desires. Them Before Us, Why We Need a Global Children's Rights Movement. And a lot of the challenge is for us adults to set aside our desires for the sake, the long view, the next generation for children. Are we losing our footing on something so basic as marriage and family in our society? I mean, I really want you to hear this as potentially countercultural for us to say, as we say, Apostles' Creed or Nicene Creed, what we believe in, Jesus Christ, if we say we believe in the family and we believe in the power of marriage, husband and wife united for better or for worse, for richer or for poorer, in sickness and health, to love and cherish, till death do us part. That's becoming more countercultural. And there's all kinds of other things. I think we're losing some of our common sense. There's things that even sound right. How about this one? Cohabitation, the rise of living together before getting married. Doesn't that sound right to test drive the relationship? That metaphor has often been used, that analogy of it's like test driving a car. But now we're decades into this. And the data is not showing that this improves marriages or the rate of divorce. In fact, it's worse for previously cohabitated couples. I want to end with my last point here. Marriage and family pointing to something even greater. Tim Keller, as he talks about marriage and God's design for it, beginning a family, which we've talked about, and what it points to in the future. He says, in fact, there are all sorts of great institutions and human enterprises that the Bible doesn't address directly. And this is true. All kinds of businesses, organizations that you're a part of, probably. Schools, the way they're organized. The Bible doesn't say us how to organize, how they're to be addressed. He says, and so we are free to invent them and operate them in line with the general principles for human life that the Bible gives us. This is true. But marriage, he says, is different. As the Presbyterian Book of Common Worship says, God established marriage for the welfare and happiness of humankind. Marriage did not evolve in the late Bronze Age as a way to determine property rights. That's another bad thing you might hear about marriage from very educated circles. Marriage evolved in the Bronze Age, or marriage is there just to support capitalism. Something like that. He says, no, at the climax of the Genesis account of creation, we see God bringing a man and a woman together to unite them in marriage. The Bible, here's the long view. The Bible begins with a wedding of Adam and Eve and ends in the book of Revelation with a wedding of Christ and the church. Marriage is God's idea.